Tisbeth Chapter, the National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Project 2. The date is May 24th, 1993. This is Eva Enger interviewing Mr. Burton Hirsch. Mr. Hirsch, would you once again kindly give us your address, please?
2704 Murray Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA, 15217.
Thank you.
217.
Thank you. Mr. Hirsch, would you please tell us something about your World War II military experience?
Yes, I was inducted into the service through Pittsburgh and ultimately had my basic training in Camp Stuart, Georgia. After the basic training at Camp Stuart, Georgia, I was sent to Camp Atterbury. I'm sorry, not Camp Atterbury. To Newport News, Virginia, Camp Patrick Henry, where I was in the medical department of the Army, in the laboratory, and trained as a medical lab technician, and was there for, I think it was a year and a half, 2 years, and then I was asked to apply for Officer Candidate School, and the request was basically a request, but fundamentally an order. And I did apply for Officer Candidate School and was accepted. Was sent to Abilene, Texas, to the medical administrator for Officer Candidate School. Completed 4 months training. Was commissioned a second lieutenant. And was stationed at Camp Atterbury, Indiana, just south of Indianapolis, and was the aide to the commanding general of the Camp Atterbury General Hospital in the remedial section, and had charge of the complete training and the attendance at remedial schools and therapy and so forth for veterans of World War II. Who had been injured and returned to the States. It went well enough to go back to duty, went sick enough to be in the hospital. And the government, feeling that they would come out of the service without any training as far as vocation is concerned, established the educational reconditioning camp as an approach to train these returnees in various phases according to their particular likes and dislikes, such as welding, photography, library, whatever particular phase that they would enjoy being in. So I spent a few years there. I spent a few years there until my discharge in 1946.
Could we sort of go back a little bit to talk about social life here in Pittsburgh, when your family was young, what sort of vacations you took, and then your hobbies.
Sure. Well, first of all, you must realize that in my early years, I had lived through some very serious depression periods here. And social life was non-existent as we know today. Family was very oriented, family orientation. And our social life really was, that is, not family social life, but social life of the offsprings and the children were basically the associations that we made through two entities. One was the religious schools of the various congregations we attended, and secondarily the schools that we attended. In those years, there was not the crossover lines, religious lines of the intermingling, for a lot of reasons. First of all, they didn't have the Christian boys and girls didn't have the same interest, obviously, that we had. And we had very strong influence by our parents of a Judaic influence and affinity. So we pretty well adhered to our own social contacts within the confines of Judaism, number one. Number two, we certainly didn't have the experience or the appetite of television that we have today. Radio was a rather limited entity. Such things like Amos and Andy shows, Graham McNamee for the news, Bertrand Hirsch, no relation, uh-huh. Concert violinist. The abilities of reading and family closeness and ties were very prevalent. And it didn't take a lot of vacations because there just wasn't the money to do so. And not only that, but we didn't have the convenience of travel that we have today. So our vacations were rather limited to the ability of going to Atlantic City, New Jersey, to the shore, Rehoboth Beach, within driving range, Erie, areas of that. And we didn't take a lot of vacations because, as I said, there just weren't the funds to do so. And the young people recognized and realized that education was a very important factor, and in order to make their mark in life, they had to bear down to the wheel as far as education is concerned. And the social relationships in those years were such that they glorified that educational appetite. So therefore, we didn't have then what we have today from the standpoint of this total informality, the total aura of let it all hang out and do what you want to do. Parents were very strict. They demanded many things of the children. Now, there were those who, of course, were very loose, obviously, nonconformists, as we called them in those days. But basically, families were very, very family-oriented, very educationally oriented, very religiously oriented. And if there was anyone that married out of their faith, it was not uncommon for the families to sit shiver. So those are things that we had and didn't have in those years.
Would you like to tell us what changes there have been in the atmosphere of Squirrel Hill since you first moved here, Mr. Hirsch?
Oh, my goodness. How much time do we have?
Oh, well, let's try and keep it in a nutshell.
Well, I realize that I'd be facetious in making that remark.
Many interviews as we want until you're finished.
Squirrel Hill has changed in character and emerged as a multilingual, multi-religious, multi-educational complex that would be very difficult to define in particular, other than to say that it's a heterogeneous mixture of many faiths, peoples, cultures, financial backgrounds, and so forth. However, as I remember Squirrel Hill as a young man, Murray Avenue was all homes. There were very, very few storerooms on Murray Avenue. It was not the religious store ability that we see today with all the kosher markets. Those kosher markets and those stores that predominantly carried articles of kosher identity or kosher really were down on in the Hill District. I'm trying to think the name of the street, and I can't think of it at the moment. But we didn't have that many stores here, and we had one movie house. It was a Manor Theater, and the young kids, so to speak, on Saturday went to the Manor Theater, which had the normal Hoot Gibson type of show and so forth. And they did have an intermission, which there was a piano playing or something of that nature. And you met your friends at the theater. And you didn't meet them before and take them to the theater because everyone had their own financial abilities and you just weren't able to splurge, so to speak. On 4th Street, there was a newsstand. There was a stand called Yunks Newsstand. I believe it was spelled Younks, which is still there in the form of the Squirrel Hill Newsstand. And it was half the size that it was, and most all the young kids would just save whatever they could save to go into Yunks Newsstand and buy the little transfers or little toys that were very important to them. To occupy time in their spare time. The social relationships were established along the lines, again, of the Christian, not the Christian, of the Jewish orientation of the children that were from Beth Sholem, made their social relationships, and through those relationships were one particular clique, if you will, Rhoda Sholem similarly, and Shartor, the other Shartor, of course, wasn't here at that time. But the other Orthodox congregations that were here did find that same type of attitude of social relationships. And coupled with the experience of Autodice High School and Junior High School, Colfax High School, supplied the other abilities of interrelationships and so forth. Squirrel Hill was clearly defined as a Jewish neighborhood up to, let's say, Forward Avenue, and from Forward Avenue towards Homestead, then it was defined very definitely as a Catholic neighborhood. So there was always a close relationship. There was that element of problems that existed, but not on the enormity that we have today. Everyone lived in a rather coexistent harmony. Didn't have a lot of problems. There were the normal fights up at Alderdice that you would find at any school, but not the guns, knives, dope, and so forth that we have today, by any shape of the stick. And Squirrel Hill was a very pleasant place to live. Forbes Street was beginning to emerge as a very, very outstanding specialty shop area. People would come from all over the city in the area to come to Squirrel Hill shop. So the area of Squirrel Hill was a close place to live, a nice place.
And there was not a sense of anti-Semitism here?
Oh, there was always, I think, a sense of anti-Semitism, which really came from the Greenfield area. I don't know whether it was anti-Semitism or just pure envy. I don't know which it was. Maybe it was envy that later came to surface in the form of anti-Semitism. There was always anti-Semitism, yes, no question about it. Christian parents certainly didn't want their children mingling with the Jewish children any more than the Jewish parents wanted the same relationships.
We're talking about what, post or pre-World War II?
Pre-World War II.
Pre-World War II.
We're talking about in the early 30s to middle 30s.
Mm-hmm. What was the climate like politically? In this part of the city and in the city as a whole, can you recall?
Well, I can't give you too much of a background of the political history at that particular time, but I wasn't too conscious out of need or desire to know about politics at that time. However, as I do remember, Pittsburgh politicians were products of the Hill District. And the Hill District was a melting pot. And the politicians who were mature in their life and in their beliefs had a very, very close relationship with Jew and Catholic and Protestant. So there was a harmonious relationship as far as politics were concerned. The political scene at Pittsburgh, of course, was always dominated by to a degree by Republicans up to a certain point, because business, such as the steel mills and the glass mills of the area, iron and steel, were largely owned and dominated by the financial entities, of course, and they supported the more conservative type of approach that was provided by the Republican seen as the workers in this country merged into a union, we found more and more of a combined approach by the union to politicize the city, finding their strength in numbers. Of course, we have the horrible iron glass police in Pittsburgh in the early 1800s or very early 1900s, which provided some horror stories of which I've only heard and certainly wasn't aware of. So politically, the scene was a pretty harmonious scene. We had politicians in those days, in my estimation, who, while politically inclined to do the things for their people they wanted to do, nevertheless were interested enough in the city that everybody benefited from it. Everybody benefited. We had a lot of idealism. We had a lot of thinking people who had great ideas and great thoughts about what this place should and would be. I like to think that the politicians today are equally as disposed. I don't know whether they are or not. We certainly have a political scene that is not, in my estimation, for the overall good of the city. But follow political lines. What's good for the political is good for the politician to be in office.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I want to go back, too, because I did mention we're interested to know something about your personal hobby.
Oh, my hobbies? Well, I've always been interested in railroading, miniature trains. I did a lot of model building as a youngster, both from the standpoint of railroads and airplanes. I think everyone did that to a degree. However, my main hobby, as far as hobbies, has always been photography.
Uh-huh.
I was brought up on photography. My father loved photography. My father was a reporter in his very early years with his father at the newspaper, the reporting in those days wasn't as it is today, where you would have a police radio and run and follow a siren and so forth. It was more of a latent thing of stories that would come up and you would go to investigate and so forth. And I became interested in news photography. So my main hobby has always been photography. Of course, I emerged later in years into a lot of other directions as well, such as needlepointing, video now. Golf, always been golf. I've been playing golf since I've been about 10 years of age.
What took you to, what interested you about needlepointing, or how did you start on that?
Well, I, as a youngster, had an accident with my right leg, my knee. And over the years, kind of had to protect that knee after surgery on the knee. And fortified the knee with a lot of experience, a lot of exercise and so forth, it became very strong. So my left knee took a lot of abuse that normally protected my right knee. And I developed what they called, I can't tell you the medical term for it, but it was a disintegrating kneecap in my left knee. And I had an episode many years ago where the knee just blew up, filled with water and so forth, and had to have that tapped and removed. And the doctor told me that if I had another episode like that, of course, I would unquestionably have to have a prosthesis for the kneecap, which I did not want to do. So I am overprotective of that kneecap, and for about 2.5 to 3 months, I'm not allowed to do much other than just sit and keep the leg raised. So I became involved in rug hooking and anything at all, plus reading. There's only so much reading you can do. Until a friend of mine, Erwin Wolf from the I.D. Wolf, the Coffin family, who got into some needlepointing, interested me in needlepointing, and of course I started needlepointing as a result.
Actually, we had a family friend in England who started a tapestry after a serious heart attack and had it stretched, and then any time anybody came to visit, he would invite us to help it with it, which
sure.
Is sort of nice. That has been of interest. So we covered all the hobbies now?
I believe so.
Yes?
I believe so.
I would like to ask a question. What do you have, do you have any of this in your home, or where do you display?
Well, I don't display anything. I make things as a gift, give away. I've made golf club covers, I have some friends that have hearing aids. I made little hearing, little purses for their hearing aids. My wife complains that I make her a lot of purses, and of course it's going to cost her because of every purse she has to go buy a dress for that purse. And she hasn't begun to wear all the purses, so I just make purses constantly for her. I look for flea markets to buy these old frames, the old silver frames, and then design a purse accordingly and make a purse for her. Just finished one not too long ago. She has all the purses. She has all the purses. The golf club covers, well, they're all over the city.
Are you currently involved in community institutions?
What happened to this
community? Community institutions.
Oh, yes. I'm a member of the board of directors of the ZOA. I'm on the Brotherhood board of Rochelle Temple. Israel Bonds. I'm board of Israel Bonds. I'm the lifetime member of the board of directors of Jewish National Funds, by virtue of having been as president for 3 years. So I think that's about the major organizations.
And in your synagogue, do you have any role at this time?
Rochelle. I'm on the board of the Brotherhood of Rochelle. So.
You talked about the war. What about the Depression and Prohibition? Were these factors any influence on your life, what you're saying?
Well, the Depression, of course, had a great influence on my life. Prohibition had really no effect to me at all, other than we lived, as I said, in Homewood, and one of our neighbors was a gentleman who was the general manager of Electric Carbonic Corporation. And they supplied all the gases and so forth to the various stores, drug stores and so forth, for their fountain pops that they used to sell. And in my early years, I can recall, if you didn't win, I bought a Coca-Cola. They supplied the carbonic waters and so forth, and they mixed it with the sodas and so forth right on the spot. And that's something I wish we had back in Pittsburgh again, but that's a gone historic thing of the drug stores. We used to win and buy an ice cream soda and sit and talk and chat and so forth. But at any rate, in those years, Prohibition, my father was a gourmet cook. He loved to cook. And one who loved to cook, he enjoyed a glass of beer occasionally. He wasn't an alcoholic by any shape of the spit, and detested liquors of all types, but did enjoy a glass of beer once in a while. Of course, there was no place that you could buy a glass of beer during Prohibition. So he and this gentleman by the name of Bill Bartels used to make a keg of beer at home. And when they would work on their radio, which I told you about earlier, which didn't walk in, buy a radio and turn it on, and listen to see if they could get Rochester, New York, or Buffalo, New York, and so on and so forth, they would have a glass of beer. Mm-hmm. And that was the only effect that Prohibition years had on me at all. Depression, oh yes, I'm one that has depression mentality, absolutely, and I'm glad I do. I buy a pair of shoes, and it just breaks my heart to take them out of the closet and put them on, because I keep them as long as I can. My wife says, at my age, you don't save anything. But yes, depression had a great effect on me. You learn to conserve, you learn to save, you don't waste. Absolutely.
What influence did the we've talked about World War II, Korean War have on you?
No, they had no influence on me, other than just general knowledge of reading papers and listening to television and so forth.
What about the civil rights movement?
Same thing. I'm not one who believes in discriminatory attitudes. I believe very strongly that everyone is equal to their own feeling and belief, as long as they don't legislate their belief on me.
And what about the birth of the State of Israel?
Well, I think everybody was enthralled with that. I can remember that very definitely, sitting and listening to that on radio and television from more radio than television. I think that, as I look at it, other than the fact that it was very important, the State of Israel gave a certain dignity to Jews in the world. Dignity, not that they didn't have dignity before, but it dignified their position. And it gave them the support that they didn't have to be afraid anymore to hide behind a curtain as a Jew. They could come out to the forefront and say, I am Jewish and be proud of it. And I think the State of Israel was very important in that aspect, obviously. Aside giving a home to the Jewish people and land to so on and so forth. But I think that was the fundamental thing that I saw.
Yeah, there's a little more time on here than all that.
Yes,
as we were
sure.
Could we talk about business life, relationships with your colleagues and employees, for example? I mean, how many people do you employ on your staff?
Well, we have we have 7 regular employees and 3 part-time employees. I have always had, the day I opened employees here, 1 or 2. And of course, I have a business more than that. We have a very good relationship. My people, of course, know, we're in fact the only business we do is a Jewish business. We're not called upon to do any Christian things at all, ever. And they have great respect for the Jewish community. I think, in reality, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but as I see it, if I were to hire a young man who was a Jewish boy, if there were available any Jewish boys for this type of work and license, they might not have the same air of respect for the Jewish community and rabbis as some of the Christian boys do.
We were
going to
ask him.